The title of the book, Hyman paid very, very close attention to his titles throughout all of his work, and often liked to quote pieces of biblical text and sort of give people the idea that what he was doing was playing with certain kinds of quasi-scriptural insights. So you end up with these titles that allude to different parts of the text. There's another novel that he writes in the 1970s called And I Will Fear No Evil, which kind of relates back to one of the Psalms. But this one in particular, though, Stranger in Strange Land, this is the King James translation of Exodus 2:22, which is the particular passage in which Moses, having been exiled from Egypt, finds himself in another country and is, gets involved with the folks there and ends up marrying Zipporah and has a son. And when he has a son, then the son he names Gershom, for I have been a stranger in a strange land. Which is an interesting sort of Hebrew derivation about what Gershom actually means, something about foreigner who wanders. So that's kind of what the book is an allusion to. It's not Hyman's original title, and in fact, in all of the documentary evidence of people thinking about titles for the book, when Hyman and his editor and his wife were kicking names around, Stranger in a Strange Land doesn't actually show up as the name. It only actually appears for the first time in a contract after the book has already been done. For a while Hyman was writing it, he referred to it as the Mowgli story. It was the Jungle Book, except instead of the person being raised by jungle animals, the human is raised by Martians. So that was part of Hyman's original idea for where this would come from. The proximate title for the book was The Sound of His Wings, in which was supposed to be an allusion to the angelic character of the main character, Valentine Michael Smith, who, in an interesting reveal at the end of the book, turns out to be the Archangel Michael. We'll talk about that. This is one of these gestures that Hyman makes again and again. And also, if you notice, the way that I titled the talk, I mean, this is a quotation from the very end of the book, and this is when Digby, who had been one of the prophets who was killed earlier on in the novel, then he shows up. There's a lot of life-after-death stuff that goes on in Hyman. This is something that Digby ends up saying near the end of the book. You know, certainly thou art God, but who isn't? Thou art God becomes a kind of mantra for the church that Mike, the human raised by Martians, ends up founding on the earth. The reason I like this particular phrasing is because it shows the mood that Hyman has throughout whenever he's trying to talk about sacred things. Hyman is decidedly irreverent whenever it comes to any of these things. His depictions of religion, politics, sexuality, everything is very, very irreverent and satirical and ironic, and that's just kind of the mood of Hyman. And one either really likes that and becomes kind of a Hymanite, or one is offended by it. And Hyman would be perfectly happy with either reaction. He often said that his job as a writer was simply to shock people and get them thinking about things, and he goes through this by taking various sacred cows. He once commented that Stranger in a Strange Land was to take the two most important sacred cows in Western civilization, monotheistic religion and monogamous marriage, and satirize the heck out of them. And that's basically what he does in a lot of ways in this book. All right. A couple basic facts about the publication. I've collected a few covers from the novel that I've used to illustrate this part of some of the background information that I'm going to give. The original, as far as we know, the original idea for this book actually came about in 1949. There was a contest that actually happened. And the way that contest happened is there was a book called, a magazine, a pulp magazine called Astounding Science Fiction. And someone had written a letter to the editor in which he forecast what the issue 1 year hence would look like. And he gave names of authors and names of titles of stories. And the editor, John Campbell, contacted all the authors and said, wouldn't it be cool if we actually produced that issue? And everybody said, yeah, okay, fine. So they ended up doing this. The title of the story that this letter writer had assigned to Hyman was Gulf. So Hyman has a year to come up with a story that would fit the name. And so he and his wife, Ginny, are kicking around various ideas. And one idea comes up. What about a human raised by an alien civilization that has to come back and confront humanity in all of its perplexity? So Hyman plays with this idea for a while. Went and wrote like a 14-page outline, treats the thing a little bit. Couldn't quite make it work. Ended up writing a very different story called Gulf that did show up in the November 1949 issue of Astounding Science Fiction. Kept that idea kept gnawing at him for a number of years. So it took him about a decade to go from that story treatment onto something else. Now, Heinlein was a very, very well-known science fiction author during what's sometimes called the golden age of sci-fi. Heinlein had, in fact, already won, before the publication of Stranger in a Strange Land, 2 Hugo Awards, and that's the award given every year to the best work of sci-fi or fantasy. It's given in several different categories. The novel award is for anything over 40,000 words. Heinlein had won it twice before. He won it in 56 for Double Star. He won it in 1960 for Starship Troopers. And he's an extremely well-known author to begin with. However, the thing that's interesting about Heinlein is once you got outside the sci-fi community, what Heinlein was mostly known as was an author of children's books. Because Heinlein had produced a number of juvenile space adventures, a number of novels that were primarily targeted at adolescents, things like Have Space Suit Will Travel, books that were really essentially boys and girls adventure tales that happened to be set in space. And Heinlein was very well known as a producer of these kinds of pulp sort of children's things. And they paid fairly well, and Heinlein was pretty happy with it, but he always thought of himself as an author with more to say than that. Not that he had any literary pretensions, but that he wanted to show that you could do things with science fiction that were on the order of things that J.D. Salinger was doing. Not in the same way, not in the same genre. He had no interest in writing straight non-genre fiction. But he wanted to show that sci-fi could be a vehicle for actually doing interesting things. And so the result of all of this, I mean, he sort of has written Starship Troopers, and Starship Troopers, if you actually look at it, has a lot of really, really intricate political philosophy going on underneath it. But it presents itself on the surface as kind of an adventure story about fighting aliens on foreign planets. And so he said, all right, well, I'm going to do something very different. And he writes it in a Strange Land. He writes it, and it's 220,000 words long. 800 manuscript pages, which is ridiculous. His publisher freaks out and says, no way, no way. We cannot publish a book that's 220,000 words long. So they make Heinlein cut about 70,000 words. And the way Heinlein cuts these 70,000 words is by taking the manuscript and literally tweaking every sentence in the book to remove adjectives, to take out clauses. He ends up cutting things down so the story is still there, but a lot of the sort of Heinlein-esque nuance of it is missing. For years, many serious Heinlein fans regarded Stranger as a substandard Heinlein book because it didn't read like other Heinlein books. It was a little bit too dry. It didn't have the kind of the odd Heinlein-esque wit of things like the opening sentence, right? Valentine Michael Smith was as real as taxes, but he was a race of one, which is a tremendously Heinlein-esque line. In the abridged version that was actually published, it simply said Valentine Michael Smith was real, but he was a race of one. Because you don't really need as taxes, except if you're a Heinlein fan, you know exactly what he's doing there. There's this kind of irreverent anti-government thing that's going on here. And cuts like that is what Heinlein ends up doing throughout this. So he cuts the thing, and it gets released. Comes out in 1961, doesn't really sell very well. 1963, there's a book club edition, which is the version that, sorry, 61, the book club edition here takes off, and when 63 was a paperback edition that comes out, again with the same cover. If you are familiar with the novel and you look at this cover, you know what this is. This is, of course, Rodin's sculpture, Cariatide, Who Has Fallen Under Her Stone, which actually plays a fairly important role in one rather pivotal scene in the novel where Jubal Harshaw is explaining to Ben Caxton what it is that beauty is in a sculpture and why Mike, the Martian, may have taken on something that's far too great for him and why he's eventually going to be crushed by it. This statue is something that shows up as an example. And so, at least in the beginning, the publishers understood that that was what Heinlein's real point was, and so they used this as the cover for the novel. As you'll see, later covers don't actually focus on that part of the novel quite as much. The book really takes off. The paperback edition comes out in 63, starts selling massive numbers of copies. It has now sold somewhere in excess of 5 to 6 million copies. And has never gone out of print. It's in like its 50-somethingth printing at this point. So it became an extremely popular book, but it was a bit of a sleeper when it was first released. So that much by way of talking about the sort of publication effect. See how things have changed by 1984. Now we're focusing on very different versions of the story, and much more of a kind of messianic and group swimming in the pool kind of stuff. That becomes really the things people focus on in later later versions of things. What I'm going to suggest that we do with this book, I'm going to suggest that we read this. I said earlier that Heinlein delighted in using science fiction to illuminate certain things about human society by showing us contrasts. So aliens in Heinlein are largely occasions for talking about the peculiar things about humanity. And almost, it's very, very pronounced here, because you've got a human who's raised by Martians, who's then brought back to Earth and has to learn all about human society. So you can treat this, as you can treat large quantities of science fiction, as a kind of thought experiment. A naturalist thought experiment designed, to use the phrase that Ursula Le Guin, a sci-fi author, was fond of using. The sci-fi doesn't tell you about the future. Sci-fi tells you about the present. It tells you about the present by using notions of the future as a literary device to make you think more critically about the present. And that's clearly what's going on in a lot of Heinlein's work. So you can think of it as a kind of thought experiment, and in particular you can think of it as what we might call a naturalist thought experiment. One of the sort of rules of science fiction is that things that happen that appear to be miraculous have to have some kind of scientific or scientistic explanation to them. Now, Heinlein runs right up to the edge of that genre convention and occasionally just pokes holes in it because he has angels floating around at various points in the book. Though they're presented in this irreverent way that makes them just seem like people who just happen to have died and gone on to the next level. And they're just there doing ordinary things. So Heinlein tries to bring the whole thing within this kind of basically naturalist account. And there's actually moments in the novel where he really runs after that by saying, here's something that looks like a miracle, but there's got to be a physical explanation for it. So it always comes up with some kind of physicalist explanation. And when Heinlein then, like many other sci-fi authors, who interestingly learned it from Heinlein, this is one of the guys who invented the genre conventions, this kind of naturalist thought experiment, when it's applied to thinking about society, yields what you might call a constructivist or instrumentalist or consequentialist view of society, which might be summarized as follows. Social arrangements are matters of convenience. They're created by people to serve certain kinds of purposes, and the only way to evaluate them is by their effects. Contrast this to, say, an evaluation of social order in moral terms, where we would have a set of rules that we have to see whether or not a particular social grouping adheres to. The attitude that Heinlein, like many other sci-fi authors, has is that we don't analyze things that way. We analyze things by looking at the effects that they generate. This means by imaginatively varying things, we can come up with what is essential, what is important about any human society, and therefore what kinds of social arrangements would be compatible with those things. Heinlein's account, Heinlein's theory, if you will, revolves around three things that he thinks are absolutely essential to any kind of human social order. And the message, in many ways, of the novel is that any social order that takes these three things into account would be a perfectly reasonable solution. If one is committed, sort of at the beginning of the process, to the normative and moral superiority of a particular way of organizing things, that's a shocking position. Because if you say, no, there's, you know, marriage is constitutively monogamous, and that's all there is to it, then a solution that says, well, actually, there's other ways that you could have people together to, you know, produce kids and raise them and distribute assets, it becomes very shocking to sort of move off of that. If you think, and this is actually becomes tremendously important in a second, if you think that language is a neutral mechanism through which we represent the world, then to say different languages are going to represent the world in different ways, and some of those languages are going to allow you to do things that you couldn't do in other languages, that becomes a shocking position. Right? So it disrupts the normative or moral investment that we make in a particular kind of social order. Heinlein, as I said, has three basic things he thinks we have to take into account. One, would be that humans are language-using creatures, and he has a very specific thing that he means by language-using creatures. There's a dialogue that I'll talk about in a second in the middle of the book about language and mapping, which actually I think is really important with revealing what it is that Heinlein thinks about this stuff. There is a second basic feature of humanity, which, and I know the next talk in this series is going to be on Rand's At the Shrug, which is the book that the publisher didn't require cutting 70,000 words. Anyway, I can think of 70,000 words that could be cut. But the thing that makes Heinlein, though he is something of a libertarian in some of his other work, different from someone like Rand, is that Heinlein's individuals are not simply disconnected folks interacting through a market. Heinlein suggests that there's something about human beings that, despite our basic individuality, that human beings have a capacity for very deep and profound connection with one another. So community, in some ways, is just as important to Heinlein as individuality is. Now, of course, what he means by community is a little bit different than what other people mean by community, but we'll get into that. So those are those two, and then there's a third one, which is the one that I will say struck me the most strongly on rereading this book, not as a 14-year-old. What you might call the sexual dimorphism of human beings, which is to say Heinlein has, and throughout the novel, polices a very, very strict male-female differentiation. And if one doesn't fit into Heinlein's categories of male and female, it is virtually impossible to find a place in Heinlein's society. And he says at one point, actually makes a comment at one point, that a male who is not firmly masculine would probably have some wrongness to him. This is the 1960s, so on one hand you could sort of look at it in terms of social norms at the time. On the other hand, certainly by the 1960s there were people arguing other things. I don't want to say this by way of trying to evaluate Heinlein's position, but I think these are important touchstones that show up in the book. So what does Heinlein then do with these things? I'm going to talk briefly about each of those three points. But before I do that, I want to bring out the word that's already been mentioned, which is the immediate contribution of this book. It's actually in the Oxford English Dictionary now. The word grok. It exists. It's an actual word. It is not the first sci-fi coinage to actually make its way into the Oxford English Dictionary. That was actually Dalek, coming from Doctor Who. But grok was the first sort of Americanized sort of word like this that really makes its way in, shows up in the OED, and is defined, according to the OED, according to my copy of the OED, which is an older edition, but I don't think they've changed it that much, intuitive understanding, empathy, rapport, etc., etc. So this is the way that the OED defines grok. Heinlein himself has about 90 different definitions in the course of the book. In fact, a lot of the plot hangs on the untranslatability of this particular term, which is, the way Heinlein describes it is interesting. He describes it as a sound in the back of the throat. It sounds like you're gargling or something. So he gives you a sense of like what it might sound like, but of course, no one speaks it. It's a novel, right? So you don't actually, you distance from the word even further because you don't hear anybody saying it. When we get to our first actual definition of the book, Valentine Michael Smith himself defines grok as drink, but then as he's talking to Dr. McMood, they go on and describe a variety of other things that the term could also mean. In fact, that's it's a very important passage where they're actually having this discussion, where he says that there are hundreds of other words, in fact, and I'll have to read it later, there are hundreds of other words that grok would sort of would link into. So this idea, which is tremendously important to Mike, the Martian, human raised on Mars, but also very important to the religion that he ends up founding, this idea that I quoted at the beginning, the thou art God idea, is Mike's attempt to translate this, its untranslatability and the gap, the gulf, remember what the story came from, between the Martian language and the way it sounds in English is a tremendously important piece of it. But grok sums up all of these three points of Heinlein's, because we end up here talking about the capacity for deep connection. We end up talking about a very strict male-female binary when grok turns out to, among other things, mean sex, and particularly group sex, and the fact that it's a language sort of accentuates the importance of language to Heinlein's conception of things. So by the time we get to 1987, right, now we're focusing on something entirely different. Right? So this now becomes the cover that they could use quite a bit. So the Martian language, which is a part of Heinlein's conception here, Heinlein's philosophy of language, if you will, is that different languages have a different map of the universe. So in this version, if we look here at page 264, we can actually see Heinlein talking about this. This is actually the phrase I was thinking of a moment ago. So a discussion between Jubal and Mahmoud about maps and languages, right? That language itself shapes a man's basic ideas. Right? Mike thinks in Martian, and this gives him an entirely different map of the universe from that which you and I use. So for Heinlein, language is not just a way of representing things. Language is a particular kind of intervention, a particular grid that gets laid down on top of the universe and allows you to perceive things in different kinds of ways. So questions of translation are central to how Heinlein thinks about this stuff. In particular, this is one of the things you can do in science fiction that's awful hard to do not in science fiction. You can say things, as Heinlein has Jillian say to Ben at one point, "Oh, I just whistled to it in Martian." She's describing how a pack of cigarettes levitated off the table and flew into her hand. So the idea here is that language is not just a particular map of the universe, but is a map that allows you to do things that might not be possible in other maps. The Martian map lets you do things like manipulate matter in ways that English doesn't. So languages are also hooked into reality in different kinds of ways. And human beings apparently can learn Martian because a lot of Mike's church turns out to be a language school. So they're learning Martian so they can do different kinds of things. The untranslatability of Martian back into English, again, when Heinlein actually wants to make one of these points, he tends to put it in Jillian's mouth. Jillian is the person who sort of articulates the most sympathetic but also sort of learning Martian human response. That's Jillian. And then the one who is the most human response without bothering to learn Martian is Jubal Harshaw. So we have a sort of interesting juxtaposition of the two of them. And the first posing of a theme that becomes more important in some of Heinlein's later novels when there is some sexual attraction between the father figure and the daughter figure. Heinlein gets into a lot of that stuff later to Sail Beyond the Sunset, which is a book we're not talking about, is one that's very difficult to actually discuss without violating various kinds of content restrictions because of the way Heinlein does this. But when Jillian is talking to Mike about this, the phrase she's referring to here that doesn't say the same thing in English is that phrase, "Thou art God," which Mike is able to say in Martian, and Jillian sort of understands in English, but then really understands once she learns Martian, but it can't be translated. So there's this idea that in order to have a viable society, you have to take account of the fact that human beings have this language, that they're plugged in particular kinds of ways, and that if they're plugged in different ways, different things become possible. So that's one of the things that Heinlein is doing here. As I suggested earlier, this introduces a certain relativity of languages and says that when we think about the organization of human society, we shouldn't start off with the idea that there's just one naturally superior language, that different languages are good for different things. So this is a kind of pluralism or relativism that Heinlein introduces there. And then, after that, he introduces a certain, as you can see, the image becomes very popular and sort of remains in paperback editions. After this, then Heinlein introduces a certain amount of relativism to the ways in which human beings connect. He says human beings have a deep capacity for connection, but they can connect in very different kinds of ways. And how a particular society chooses to honor and celebrate certain forms of connection, Heinlein says, in a sense, doesn't really matter which one you choose. There are a lot of different kinds of ways of doing this that are compatible with humans' basic capability to connect. And in very sort of sociological terms, he takes religion and treats religion as simply a form of connection. So if you, one can almost imagine this coming out of Emile Durkheim, right? Religion is something that we human beings create to order ourselves in particular ways. The other reference point here would be something like William James and his pragmatic approach to religion and varieties of religious experience, where the idea is that religion is not so much a matter of doctrine as a matter of social organization. And that social organization, Heinlein suggests, feeds that need for deep connection. Religion is simply about allowing people to connect in various sorts of ways. And the effects are what's important here, not the truth of any particular doctrine. You end up with connections between members of Mike's church in Martian because they're all learning Martian, so there's an interplay of the language and the capacity for connection. The kind of connection that people are apparently capable of is not just through speaking or anything else, but actually through thought sharing, right? So that there is this deeper level that they can somehow get to. This is exemplified for Mike and for the book in the water sharing ceremony, so of course I have to have some water here. And though it's not well fleshed out, Heinlein leaves us enough clues and then actually explains it in more naturalistic detail in a novel that he wrote around the same time called Podokind of Mars, in which he actually talks about the structure of the Martian race in ways that are just hinted at in this book. Because of the scarcity of water on arid, dry Mars, water takes on a lot of symbolic importance. And not just symbolic importance, but practical importance, because if people know that the Martians don't have water, then they, being biological creatures, still need to have water at a certain point in time. So that explains how water becomes the central element to the procedure. And the deepest connection that one can have, or second deepest connection one can have in the Stranger in a Strange Land cosmos, is the simple act of sharing a glass of water. And so by doing this, and by turning it into a religious ceremony, again, Heinlein introduces that relativism. Not all connections have to be mediated by sacraments. They can be mediated by other things that take on that same kind of role of exemplifying connection. So in one of the more striking scenes in the novel in the very beginning, which is interesting, not striking at the time, it's very mundane, but then when you think back on it, there's a moment where Jillian, a nurse, comes in to Mike into the hospital and does what any nurse does and asks the patient if the patient's thirsty and gets him a glass of water. Now, she has no idea what she's getting herself in for, none whatsoever. But this simple thing, where she hands him a glass of water, and he sort of makes a little ritual out of it and responds to her properly and formally. And from that moment on, he's willing to do basically whatever she says, and he expects the same in return because water brothers trust each other implicitly. So there is this very interesting sort of sacralization of this small thing. Now, if one's a devout religious believer in particular kinds of rituals, they say, well, that wasn't it. That wasn't my ritual. That's not right. Heinlein flips it on its head. No. If you invest it with that kind of authority, it is a ritual of that sort. And even if it's an everyday mundane thing, it can take on much more importance. So we have that kind of relativizing of religion here to turn it into just another means for connection. Now, I said it was the second most important way of connecting in Heinlein, and in Stranger in particular. And as you read most of Heinlein's novels, you discover that, in fact, this is not just common to Stranger, but it's common to everything Heinlein wrote. The most important way of connecting turns out to be sex, and in particular, Heinlein has a particular affection for certain kinds of group sex and group marriage. There are all sorts of interesting biographical speculations about why that was the case. I'm not even going to touch those. I'm just going to point out that this is a recurrent theme in a lot of Heinlein's novels, and in particular in Stranger in a Strange Land, where you end up with the nest, the group that is collected around Mike, which is involved in a communal group marriage kind of situation, and that is the deepest form of connection that they have. These ceremonies of water sharing are described in sort of bacchanal-like terms. Though, interestingly, we don't get a direct view of them in here. Heinlein, in other writings, had pointed out that the reason he didn't do that is because he knew that you could only push the envelope so far in 1959. By the time you get to a novel like To Sail Beyond Sunset, which is his last one, all of those restraints have disappeared, and he's perfectly happy to depict things that he just kind of hints at in the earlier stuff. But point remains that the kind of connection that is the deepest here becomes this group marriage connection. And it's important that it's a group marriage. It's not just a group of people involved in orgies. It's a marriage, and he describes it that way very explicitly. Once again, if one thinks that marriage is somehow sacredly defined as one man, one woman, this is shocking. But back to Heinlein's overall social pragmatism, it's an arrangement that he thinks is going to be perfectly workable in certain circumstances. And this is I'll come back to this point in a minute. I just want to foreshadow it here. Heinlein never thought that what he was giving in this book was a blueprint. This was not an instruction manual. And he actually got very, very angry at people who treated it as an instruction manual. I'm actually going to close with that. But before I do that, let me talk about the third thing that Heinlein, here and in other parts of his work, seems to think is absolutely essential about human beings, which is the dichotomy of male and female, and the absolute dichotomy of male and female, the doubleness that shows up here. That is something that he thinks you have to build into a human society. This is not an androgynous society that Heinlein is interested in. It is a form of biological essentialism where everything is divided. All human activities are clearly divided into male and female. All human persons are clearly divided into male and female. And, as I had mentioned once before, Heinlein even points out or claims at one point that a man who was not male enough would probably not be welcomed into Mike's nest, nor a woman who was not female enough. So Heinlein's got very, very clear ideas about gender roles and how they are hard-coded into people's biology. There is a form of what we might, if we use terms that have been introduced into cultural studies since the 1960s, we would perhaps refer to Heinlein's stance here as a very strong heteronormativity. Homosexuality, he says, would be a wrongness. Points this out on page 375. Though, interestingly, he sort of like doesn't quite have the courage of his own convictions, because at other times he talks about men kissing men in very deep ways, but he doesn't really depict it. There's a weird comment where Ben Caxton sort of says that he kind of blushes, and then they move on. But at other points, I'm like, no. You know, there can be lots of interesting sexual things going on. It's always men and women. That's how it has to be. That you couldn't have homosexuals in this particular society, because nor obviously could you have lesbians. There's a comment on page 494 that kind of summed it up for me, and I will admit that this is not one that 14-year-old me remembered. This is not one that I retained from my multiple readings of the book. There's other sections that made a much deeper impression on me. But on 494, when Dawn is talking to Jubal and attempting to make Jubal consent to have sex with her, Dawn makes the comment that men like how women look, and you know, that's okay. There's a whole section in the middle where Mike and Jillian discover how good it is for exhibitionism to happen, and how good it is for women to parade themselves and men to look at them, and that's a perfectly natural and healthy thing. Shocking for the 1960s, a little bit weird when you read it now. But the comment that Dawn ends up making is men may like how women look, but women don't care about that. Women like how men are. They like their inner strength, and that's really what they like, which is a theme that shows up again and again in Heinlein about the different ways that chivalry is supposed to work and what men look for in women and what women look for in men and so on. Point is not necessarily what the terms of it are. The point is that it's absolutely different. And Heinlein says it's got to be different. You've got to have, society has to be based on that sexual polarity between males and females. And of course, everybody else in most Heinlein books, especially after Stranger, every consenting adult basically has sex whenever they can. This is a common theme in Heinlein, and one of the things that is, of course, fairly shocking about his depictions of life in the nest, is there's lots of indiscriminate sex going on. Again, within a group marriage context, so that's important to remember. But it is that male-female sexual dichotomy that Heinlein thinks you have to figure out how to manage in society somehow. The difference, to go back to my main theme about relativizing, is that Heinlein doesn't think there's anything particularly sacred about one man and one woman. And he says if there are other ways of handling sexual dimorphism, then we should experiment with those, and we should do that. He does this in Stranger, in another novel, in The Moon of Harsh Mistress. He talks about the living conditions on the moon being such that there were far fewer women than men, because it was a prison colony and more men were exiled there than women. So he invents a different social structure for The Moon as a Harsh Mistress, in which women get to basically do whatever they want sexually with anyone, and males respond by allowing and defending the honor of the woman if the woman says that she wants her honor defended, and that's about it. So the women have absolute power within these sexual relations because of the numerical thing. So it's a different kind of arrangement. Heinlein, throughout his work, plays with different ways to organize male-female dichotomies. The dichotomies are the same, but the organization changes and gets relativized as things go on. So whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is, or a progressive or a regressive thing is something we should probably think about. But what I want to do here is I want to leave us with some questions about the novel. And this is Heinlein. If there's a character in the novel, I mean, one thing we always run into when we read fictional novels is we try to look for the author in the novel, and often I think this is a mistake. I mean, it's certainly not the case that Heinlein, that Heinlein's voice is one particular character here. You know, Mike the Martian says various things, and that sounds like Heinlein. Jillian says things, and that's probably Heinlein. To make sure that people got the point, in the early 1970s, he wrote this novel called That Will Fear No Evil, in which he tells it from first person, but he keeps alternating between males and females to try to disrupt the idea of where the authorial voice is. Though, interestingly, Heinlein's females often talk an awful lot like male fantasies of females, so there's some wackiness there. It's not as bad there as it is in a book like Friday, but, you know, a different conversation. The author is generally not a character in the novel, right? The author is the one who put the whole world together. So when we read, we should be careful of identifying any particular character, though if there's one in the book that comes closest to Heinlein's own voice, then it would be Jubal Harshaw. The octogenarian lawyer and doctor who is also something of a hack author and is very important to actually pulling off this whole thing of bringing Mike in and letting him figure out how humanity works. But even with Jubal, it's not always the case that that's Heinlein. There are certain warnings that Jubal issues, such as his suggestions that Mike's way of teaching humanity to act in a particular way may be too good for humanity, that they may be too angelic and too innocent, and that there are going to be consequences. And one of the lines that always did stick with me, even as 14-year-old me, Jesus was crucified for preaching without a police license, which is Jubal's take on these questions of political and religious authority. So Jubal comes close to Heinlein, but he's not quite exactly Heinlein. So I think we really have to think more about the plot when we try to figure out Heinlein's point here. It is an open question whether Mike succeeds in helping humanity or not. On the one hand, he teaches Martian and leaves people who are involved in learning these things. On the other hand, he's murdered publicly. He does not end up, in fact, reforming all of human society. He ends up becoming a martyr. It is unclear whether even the people that he has worked with are going to be able to keep going without him, though the implication is they'll at least be able to continue for a little while. So whether Mike succeeds or not is an open question here, whether the plot is supposed to be ultimately optimistic or ultimately pessimistic. And then Heinlein throws a curveball into it if we think we understand what's going on with this weird final scene where Valentine Michael Smith, the man from Mars, turns out to actually have been the Archangel Michael taking a quick vacation on Earth, a quick break from playing solipsism, which is apparently all the rage of games up in heaven. And then he shows up, and the last line of the novel, right? The last line of the novel, he's there, and he says he could see a lot of changes he wanted to make. So apparently the work is never done. And I want to leave you, before we open it up for some discussion, I want to leave you with this. This is actually from Heinlein's correspondence. I had said that Heinlein really didn't think of himself as somebody who was actually presenting a blueprint for a new society. Heinlein was a sci-fi author. He's trying to critique. He's trying to raise various sorts of questions. Right soon after this book came out, soon after it started to become a bestseller, Heinlein was grouped in with a variety of other authors of the early 1960s preaching free love and communal living and so on, which, of course, you could really only get that was Heinlein's point by reading selectively in the book and not really seeing the problems that he raises and forgetting the basic point that none of this works in Heinlein unless everybody speaks Martian, which is a problem because I don't think many of these commons were speaking Martian. But Heinlein, a reader wrote to him in the late in the early 1970s asking to basically be able to use the book for founding their own cult. And they wanted Heinlein's permission and blessing to do this. And Heinlein said, absolutely not. And so the person wrote back and said, well, why? And Heinlein wrote in this very long essay from which I've excerpted this particular phrase that I think really sums this up. Right? I would never undertake to be a prophet. That's not what Heinlein had in mind. Instead, Heinlein thinks of himself as someone who's raising serious, non-trivial questions. Anyone who takes that book as answers is cheating himself, he said, speaking of Stranger, speaking of the book that is probably the most well-known of his works outside of the sci-fi community. It is probably not his best book. It is probably not even the best exploration of these themes. It achieved a certain level of success, I think, because it caught certain elements of the zeitgeist. And unfortunately, many people tried to turn it into a bit of a Bible, contrary to what Heinlein himself would have us do, I think, which is try to put ourselves in the position of the alien, the stranger in a strange land, and try to question the things that we find strange from that perspective, but in our ordinary lives we take for granted. That kind of thought experiment, I think, is what Heinlein is really going for, and that, I would suggest, is the best thing we can actually do with a book like this. So I will stop there. Now the fun part, which is where we get to talk about it. So, with that by way of a set of background things for us to think about, what struck you in this? It touched on elements of this. The whole thing of the UN having taken over from the United States, and there's a whole series of other political commentaries that are sort of in here, too. So. Cool.
I think it was interesting what you were saying about the sexual dimorphism aspect of it, because I think while he does suggest that the biological reality of being male and female is something that is a distinct difference, that perhaps expressions of masculinity and femininity are something that is not essential, because when they first have Alger and Michael Smith, and they say, we have to keep women, he can't see women, we have to keep him away from them, it's an othering and a distinction that he doesn't make, because when he first sees Jillian, the nurse, he doesn't understand that she is a woman. So it's a distinction that of othering and difference that the society imposes on him rather than one that he sees as essential, I think, himself.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's a great point. When he comes in, I mean, he's a male pronouns for everything, and he refers to Jillian as he a number of times, and she's like, no, she. But the thing about that is, right, as the novel goes on, Mike seems to appreciate that distinction more and ends up not rejecting it in the sort of final form of the nest that he produces. So there's a limit to how far Heinlein would go, at least in this novel, in really rejecting that. Now, there are other novels. I've mentioned I Will Fear No Evil. One of the plot points in I Will Fear No Evil is that a gentleman, a wealthy guy, is dying, and so he arranges to have his brain implanted in the body of his secretary. And it turns out that his secretary is still there. So the two of them are together, and he gets to be a female, and she gets to be a male, and there's all this weird interpenetration of things in the brain. And then actually they end up with more people in their head at the end. So it gets very odd. But in this book, there's a limit to how far he'll push that. So the performances of gender are still rigidly typed by the time we get to the end. If Heinlein had wanted to go further, one would have suspected that that androgyny of Mike in the beginning would have continued. There's a scene when they're first with the carnival where Mike deliberately, what's the phrase that she uses? He actually... Jillian tells him to make himself more masculine, right? And he, where is this? We're not museum. No, it's after that. Yeah. Ordinary people, little chumps, right? It's right around here someplace. It's right around here, I think, we remember the passage I'm talking about, right? So where he actually says, well, Mike had grown his face to look more masculine. So you think if Heinlein was really trying to make a point about how the gender expression would be different, then Mike wouldn't have done that. So it's like it's a limit to how far Heinlein himself would go.
I was just wondering, since the ideas for this originated in 1949, when I was thinking about publishing the story for Gulf, you know, what role did, I don't know what he was doing during World War II, what role did that have in sort of, was he trying to rethink society? You know, so the artists did it before that time, but it seems like
there's an interesting book to be written about how many Golden Age sci-fi people were in the Navy during World War II. And I'm not quite sure what sort of strange psychological affinity there is there, but Heinlein and L. Ron Hubbard and Gene Roddenberry would immediately leap to mind. We're all in the Navy during World War II. Heinlein and Hubbard knew each other to some extent. There are some speculations that Heinlein's depiction of the Fosterites in this novel is equal parts a satire of the Mormons and the Scientologists. It's a little unclear exactly, you know, whether that's true. Heinlein himself was also kind of an outspoken isolationist conservative when it came to U.S. foreign policy. Just before this book, he'd actually been involved in something called the Patrick Henry Society that was really arguing that the United States should not be doing these confrontational things in other parts of the world. It should really just be pulling back and preserving the American dream at home, and that's really what they should be focusing on. A lot of Heinlein's work can also be understood, I think, as the kind of meditations on the deep tensions in the American project. It's hard to do this without contrasting Heinlein to other thinkers of the time, and I really don't want to preempt the next one on Rand, but I can't help it. The difference between Heinlein and Rand in a lot of ways is that Rand thought that you just got certain decrepit things out of the way and allowed the real natural individuality and marketness of humans to come through, and then you'd be all set. Heinlein doesn't think that. There still has to be this capacity for connection. I was just saying, well, maybe there's other ways of connecting. There's other ways of doing these things. He doesn't really lay out in this book a blueprint. And in fact, in most of his work, he doesn't really lay out a utopian blueprint. The closest he comes in some ways, is in this book called The Cat Who Walks Through Walls. And the interesting thing about The Cat Who Walks Through Walls is the blueprint that shows up at the end is a conference of all of Heinlein's characters getting together, involved in something called the World as Myth Conference, in which all of the different timelines can come together and start sort of meditating on how they differ from one another. So there's a way in which Heinlein's worlds are dissolved into sets of stories at the end of the day. He himself, politically, is very interested in individuals being able to stand strong and, you know, not having large amounts of government regulation, and you get really concerned about military overextension and so on and so forth. But I think that this novel is probably, as I said, better thought of as a meditation on what actually is essential. You know, what parts of humanity really do need to be preserved in some sort of future social order, as opposed to actually laying down either a utopian or a dystopian blueprint for what that would look like. This is not Huxley. This is not Orwell. This is not let's sound a particular kind of utopian or dystopian alarm about things. So, what does he? I don't know. I mean, we've read this. What does Heinlein want us to take away? What are we supposed to do with this besides read it and chuckle at it? I mean, what is the take-home message here?
So it seems like he wants,
but then if we think about what it is that he wants us to think about, and I've suggested that there's this theory about the essential things of humanity that kind of runs through the book. don't know, maybe there are others. Maybe I've oversimplified and missed something.
I read this book over 35 years ago at first, and then I read it again about 10 years later. And I just picked it up and read it the last few days before your talk. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that struck me that is very interesting, Hyland sets up a scheme, a system that is, and I loved at the beginning of the talk when you said he is neither in favor of a particular thought or disfavoring it. He is presenting this material. For instance, one of the things that's fascinating as part of it, and it's at the very beginning, is the not just the Water Brother incident that happens when Jillian comes in and, you know, just very pragmatically gives him water. But there's several references that he has with people about being eaten that comes from the old ones. It's very sacred. This idea of the Bacchanal idea, the celebration, which I think is tied into Jubilee, his middle initial, Jubilee Harshbaugh, has this spiritual consistency that runs from the beginning to the end, but not in a spiritual sense that we would attach any emotion to it. It's almost a logical system. And one of the interesting things, if you look at the very end, because these few comments that he makes in the beginning take us to the very end of the novel. This crucifixion, which is just brutal. And he's smiling, and it's almost when he dies, he's looking at a grasshopper to bring this whole inflated idea of crucifixion down to a grasshopper. And yet he has built, Hyland has built this and sustained this incredible system of religious metaphor all through the work that has incorporated a lot of different world religions, and he carries it to the end. So I missed that when I read it years ago, and looking at it this time, I was, oh my God.
And it's even at the level of the characters' names, as you're suggesting with Julian, right? The fact that Michael the Valentine, you think about the martyr, Valentinius, right. There's a whole series of these puns that are played. And then Hyland sort of tips his hat a little bit so that we notice this when he talks about the naming of Jubal Secretary's kids.
Right.
He says, hey, names are important. You know, they name this kid this, and you look at the etymology of it, and the etymology turns out to be, you know, we're not quite sure who the father is. And it's like, okay, well, that's an appropriate name for this. Is that Mike's kid or is that not Mike's kid? How does it go? But you're absolutely right. I mean, I think the point about the lack of emotional.
Yeah, it's just no emotion.
Logical,
it's just
exactly.
Laying it out, you look.
There's an incredible amount of world building, to use the sort of genre technical term, that goes into. This is the sort of thing that, you know, if you're a fan of Tolkien, then you're familiar with this sort of stuff as well. If you play any modern video games, where a lot of them have these intricate world plots that they've set up, there's a lot of backstory. The brilliant thing about Hyland is that he never, in any of his novels, gets caught just to explicating backstory. All the backstory is concretized in these little pragmatic moments, and he kind of hints at it. So it's like, oh, here's this thing. Let me tell you a little bit about the story of this, but only as much as you need to be able to move on. You know, the idea of this book having this sort of a Tolkien-esque appendix of the Martian language would just be silly, right? That you couldn't imagine Hyland doing that. It's clear that the backstory serves the story. And the fact that the Martian religion isn't emotive, remember the scene when Mike is at the Fosterites and starts to appreciate one of the distinctive things about human beings, which is their emotional involvement with one another. He says, wait a minute, that's kind of cool. That's something that we should, that I learned to appreciate that humans are different than Martians in exactly that kind of moment. Precisely because of the old ones, there is no emotional involvement. It's just, this is how it works. You know, they end up deciding to destroy Earth as an aesthetic thing. You know, the same way they did the fifth planet? Yeah, you know. But, you know, we're just going to set it aside for a few thousand years and kind of think about it because, yeah, it's what you do. You know, you just kind of figure it out. And I think it gives you that one note of optimism of like, well, maybe by the time they get to deal with the third planet, it won't actually be so easy. So he does have this slightly optimistic kind of end to it. But it's precisely that we get this awareness of the differences between the humans and the Martians as the book goes on. One of the important moments there is that sexual dimorphism. Because as Heinlein lays out in Podokan of Mars and in other places, you know, the Martian life cycle is that all the young ones are female and all the old ones are male. So there's a change of gender that goes on as they move from particular states of Martian being. But that's very different. So right after that sequence at the church, or the sequence of the Fosterites, I think it's not an accident that that's the moment where Mike and one of the many women in Jubal's house end up having sex for the first time. That's the moment where you sort of recognize the distinctive thing about human beings being that emotional and physical involvement tied around the act of reproduction, which you couldn't have in Mars. So it becomes very aware that this is something else. So then it's interesting, just to finish the point, that the religion that he builds is equal parts Martian logic and carnival. Right? Adopting this sort of emotional carnival language of the blow-off and tips and marks and all of this language that he's picked up by traveling with this traveling circus. And that becomes, if you think about the point that Heinlein is then making there, sure, what is religion? Well, it's an interesting blend of religion and circus.
Right.
And it doesn't have any particular transcendental content to it. Not at all a shocking thought now, but a tremendously shocking thought in the 1960s. I mean, this is a huge moment of you know, Heinlein's a blasphemer. You know, precisely because he's not giving you what you expect.
Can I mention one other thing? You referenced that you were talking about that, I found extremely funny.
Mm-hmm.
And the also the reference to the when he's explaining about the fifth planet, which is the asteroid belt. I mean, that's a really hysterical couple pages, and it's just treated so lightly. You know, the civilization they've gone on to have this great master artwork, you know, and I kept thinking, it's like the American Indians. You know, it's kind of just laugh it off, and that's just such a classic, masterful way to write this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just, anyway.
It leads to a certain memorialization in the differences with the Martians. It becomes a big work of art. For us, it just turns into sports teams. You know, very simple talk, right? But again, there is this way in which there's something about the genre, something about science fiction that allows you to make those kinds of commentaries in ways that's harder to do in other genres. Because with sci-fi, think about the position of a sci-fi author, right? The first presupposition of a good piece of science fiction is that it's a lie. Because there's something that shows up in the first few pages that differentiates it from our world. It's not like historical fiction or contemporary fiction where you used to look at it as kind of like our world. This has got to be our world with some difference. So something gets introduced. It usually happens in the very beginning. In Star Trek, the one is when it's a very subtle one in Star Trek. It's when it's on the bridge in the first episode when one of the officers walks over toward the door and the door goes whoosh and makes the noise and opens up automatically. Which, of course, doors didn't do in the 1960s. So it was like, well, we're not in Kansas anymore. Right? How does Heinlein do it? This sort of differentia, this moment where he says, no, this is actually something different. So we're right at the very beginning of the book. And he says, once upon a time, when I was young, there was a Martian named Smith. Okay, what's he doing here? Is that just a metaphor? I don't know. Valentine Michael Smith reveals taxes to his race of one. Okay, it's still kind of metaphorical. What's going on? The first human expedition from Terra to Mars. Okay, now we know we're not in Kansas. Now we know we're in this entirely different. That position, though, as a sci-fi author, then puts you in this interesting state of having to produce something that is believable, even though it starts from an unrealistic premise. So the comments have to be recognizable, but they also have to accept that difference. So you've got to build an internally consistent world, this logical set of things that has to continue through the novel. But it also has to be plausible in a way that fantasy doesn't. You know, if Tolkien gets concerned about something that goes on in The Hobbit, then he just throws in some other ancient myth and, you know, some other god shows up or whatever. It's like, okay, cool. And you're like, yeah, all right. Yeah, makes sense to me. Throw the ring in the lotto. Sure. Right? No problem. Heinlein has to come up with a quasi-naturalistic explanation for these things because he's a sci-fi author. That's what makes him so, makes sci-fi such a great genre for commenting on society. Precisely because you have to say, all right, so this is how the Martians would do it. It's clearly not how we're doing it. That contrast allows us to bring certain features out and say, this is what's going on. It's really important over here. So, and Heinlein's a master practitioner.
You said you wouldn't talk about the impact of this book on how it shapes America. Mm-hmm. But you implied that it has shaped science fiction. Mm-hmm. That it established a number of tropes, as you put it, and influenced science fiction writers after him. So I wondered if you could comment on that.
Sure. No, that's Heinlein. I alluded earlier to the fact that Heinlein was writing during what's usually called the golden age of science fiction, which is the period of time where you have magazines like Astounding Science Fiction and Amazing Stories, which were basically publishing lots of serialized short stories and serialized novels. And that was where you found sci-fi. Most sci-fi books were not conceived as books. They were written as serialized short stories. We think of something like Isaac Asimov's Foundation, for instance. And Foundation, if you read the first three Foundation novels now, you sort of notice that they come in these little vignettes. Of course they did, because that's how much would fit in the journal. So it was like this part, and then this part, and then this part. So it was all these things that were kind of strung together. They weren't thought of as novels. The first of the Foundation novels that Asimov actually conceived of as a novel is the fourth one, Foundation's Edge, which isn't written until the mid-1980s. So sci-fi is this different kind of genre. It's published in these magazines, which are pulpy, the quality of the paper. So they're referred to as pulps. And a lot of these basic tropes were not well established. Right? Heinlein, Asimov, some of these others were the first ones to start coming up. Bradbury, you know, what would it mean to actually have a rocket ship that could get into Earth orbit? They're thinking in the early 1950s. And all of a sudden, Sputnik comes along. It's like, oh, okay, revise. All right, now we have to figure out exactly how that would go. Wait, moon, check, we'll do that. And when I actually got to the moon, okay, now I start thinking about Mars, right. Thinking about other kinds of things. So they were involved in sort of creating this stuff. There were some earlier literary precedents. There's Jules Verne, there's H.G. Wells. So there are some motifs that they pull in from them. But a lot of the standard genre conventions, we now think the standard genre conventions are kind of fought out of the pulps. And a lot of the readership of the pulps were young boys. And so there's a lot of ways that, especially the gender stereotyping in a lot of sci-fi, is the default position is very much the strong man who goes through and does many things with the scantily clad buxom woman by his side, Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, you know, that sort of thing. And then interestingly, when you get the wave of feminist science fiction in the 70s, they start with those same conventions and start inverting the heck out of them. And then, same thing in horror films, right? And then. You have the brilliance of someone like Joss Whedon coming along and saying, hey, what if the cute blonde was the one who could kill the vampire? And you have a vampire slayer, which is a whole nother talk. You want to talk about TV shows that shaped America? Let's do that one next. Do TV shows shaped America. Have me in to do Buffy. But anyway, Heinlein has won more Hugo Awards than any other science fiction author. He's won 5. He's been nominated for more Hugo Awards than any other science fiction author. He's nominated for 10. There are a lot of other younger authors who write in homage to him. There are some that he directly kind of worked with and helped to mentor, like Spider Robinson. Then there are others like John Scalzi, who never met him, but clearly read everything Heinlein ever wrote, because what Scalzi does in Old Man's War and some of his other series is he's really playing with a lot of these same Heinlein-style tropes and doing things with them. But it's really Heinlein and Asimov who kind of sketch these things out in some ways. Part of the difference between the two, right, is that Asimov is much more interested in the big stuff that becomes space opera. So it's huge, galaxy-spanning stuff. Heinlein's work tends to be a little bit more people doing things in kind of an odd, complicated context with strange, you know, new science floating around. And that then becomes, and the sort of irreverent tone toward things is something a lot of sci-fi authors pick up from him. So in a way, Stranger is a pretty good book to get an overview of like one of the core pieces of the genre of science fiction. Though in many ways, and this is the reason, one of the reasons that I don't teach Stranger in my sci-fi class, the one I tend to teach is The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And The Moon is a Harsh Mistress is also a more political book. It's more specifically focused on questions of political organization and revolution in ways that Stranger isn't. It also doesn't have quite as much of the let me throw some scenes in there that are guaranteed to sort of shock the neighbors. So he does that in Stranger. He doesn't really do that so much in Moon is a Harsh Mistress. The other neat thing about Moon is a Harsh Mistress is it's written from the first person and it's written in dialect. It's written in a kind of pidgin Russian English that had grown up among certain exiled communities on the moon. So the backstory is kind of compelling that way. But yes, a lot of these, Heinlein is definitely, if one is going to be a contemporary sci-fi author, one either embraces Heinlein and sort of writes, you know, neo-Heinleinian things, the sort of, hey, it's guns and people in space and lots of adventures and a real stress on science and the technology of the thing. So there's a way this turns into sort of what's now called hard science fiction, which has to be sort of consistent with our physics. Or, as I said, the feminist sci-fi authors who really deeply engage with and try to rewrite and undo some of those conventions. So you have someone like Sherry S. Tepper. Sherry Tepper is a brilliant novel called Grass, and in many ways, Grass is a sort of rewrite of the Stranger in a Strange Land situation, where it's humans that land on the alien planet and don't understand the aliens, and spend a lot of time trying to understand the aliens and running into some difficulties in doing so. The difference is that at the end of Tepper's novel, the lead female protagonist leaves her husband and runs off with one of the aliens, having decided that that's actually better for her and she understands that more. So the boundary crossing works in different sorts of ways. One of the other things about Heinlein is they're very human books. Humans are almost always his main characters. The one exception being in Cat Who Walks Through Walls, where Pixel, the cat, actually is a major character. It's fortunate that it's a world as myth. They can walk over to Oz and let Pixel talk because animals can speak in Oz, so they go over to Oz and they sort of, Pixel tells them things and then they go back to other places. But most of Heinlein's characters are human. Other sci-fi authors kind of relax that and sort of go off in different directions. But this idea that science fiction is in some way about the human adventure in the technological future is very much a Heinlein-esque kind of motif.
You started off by saying that it's a naturalistic thought experiment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I think it is very much placed in his particular times, mm-hmm. late 50s, or it's Cold War, the height of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Do you think if he were writing that book today, it would be the same book? What do you think that there are certain themes that would have greater prominence? Particularly if we think about Christianity in the media or some of the trends to groupthink, how those would be handled by Heinlein if you were writing that exact same story as opposed to another.
That's an interesting thought experiment question. I would say two things. I mean, obviously, one, it's not possible to give a really strict answer to this without, you know, channeling the ghost. And since, as Heinlein comments at one point, it's not so clear that our old ones actually hang around after they die like Martians do. It's kind of hard to see how we could actually bring him in to answer. But I think that if we take seriously this notion, right, that what Heinlein was trying to do is raise questions about things. And if the sort of other part of this is the things about which questions most have to be raised are exactly those things we take the most for granted. And so the literary device here, which is common to other sort of, you know, foundlings who come back into society, kinds of Tarzan and the Apes sort of stories, here's the person from outside who has to come in and relearn all those things we think of as obvious. There's a marvelous scene in here that I actually use not just in sci-fi classes, but I use when I'm trying to talk to people about social conventions and the importance of convention to things like language and understanding, where Mike refers to the stereo vision as the goddamn noisy box. One word, goddamn noisy box. Because it's just a sound, and it's just, he's associated that sound with the object, because clearly that's what Jewel calls it all the time, the goddamn noisy box. And he says, no, don't call it that, call it stereo vision. And then Mike says, but is it, no, it's a goddamn noisy box. And Jewel says, yes. And Mike gets puzzled. He says, why should I call it this? And the only answer Jewel can come up with is, Jill wants you to. He says, oh, okay. Jill wants me to, I will call it stereo vision. Think about how we teach our kids language, right? Why is that a chair? Because it's a chair. It's just a chair. Why should I call it? Because that's a chair. Oh, okay. At a certain level, it's just, as Wittgenstein would say, at a certain point, explanation ceases and only description remains. It's like, there you go. So there's a certain arbitrariness to those. And Heinlein seems to suggest those are exactly the things that we should question the most. So the literary device of having the person from outside us study these things questions those sacred cows, those untheorized things that float around. Those have changed since the 1950s. The idea of religious pluralism is not as shocking. The sort of unthought Christianity of so much of the American public sphere has been questioned in lots of ways. The sexual ethics that Heinlein brings about in the novel are in some ways really not all that shocking anymore. The idea that religion, the idea that marriage is simply one man and one woman has been questioned legally by the passing of various kinds of gay marriage laws in different states in the U.S. is clearly an object of discussion. Since the homosexual rights movements in the 1970s, you certainly had much more public acceptance of homosexuality, both for men and women, as being a form of sexuality that people have. You've also had lots of questioning of the absolute nature of the sexual dichotomy. So in some ways, it's time when we're writing this now, and we're really going to stick strongly to his declared creed here, one of the first things he'd have to question would be his own rather unthinking adherence to strict male-female dichotomy. Because that one seems to be, that's still there. It's like, well, we've got to question this in some ways. Other elements of this, like the idea, the idea of life after death and sort of exactly what that means, and that might be something that one would still sort of question. But I think, actually, that looking back on it now, the thing that if I think Heinlein were writing this now, I think that the thing that he would be perhaps most concerned to knock off the pedestal would be what you might call the anthropocentrism of so much of our society now. It's all about humans, and that's it. We think about humans and human affairs, and that's how we do things. And yes, we have lots of human plurality and human diversity. And as our friends in the deep ecology movement have been reminding us for a long time, there's a lot of other stuff going on out there that maybe we need to think about a little bit more clearly. So I can imagine a 2014 version of Valentine Michael Smith accentuating that sort of environmental oneness element perhaps a little bit more to make people think about this a bit. And I don't know, I kind of like to think that if he were trying to tell the same story now, that the Martians would be in some ways more alien. That it would be, yes, he said we can't translate, but people can learn the Martian language and then they seem to understand it. I wonder if maybe of writing it now, he would dwell a little bit more in the idea that there are some things that we can never quite understand perfectly. Now, the author who does this the best in some ways is Stanislaw Lem, who writes a lot about alien contact that's totally incomprehensible. Of course, it's got cards, so he tries to do this a little bit too, and then unfortunately people make Hollywood movies out of it that completely butcher the point of the novel. Then again, Carr did a pretty good job butchering the point of his own novel and stuff he's written since then. But the idea that the alien can't actually be understood, that you can't actually become them, that they just remain permanently other, that's not a conceptual space that's here in Heinlein. Neither he nor Asimov, actually, and none of the classic sort of golden age sci-fi folks really have a space for an alien other that's so alien that you can't understand it. But that becomes a critique that later authors will then bring in. You have aliens that aren't just, what's the Star Trek cliche, forehead of the week? It's a person walking around, but they just happen to have some strange costume on. right? That they're just basically people. For Roddenberry, that was like an article of faith. Everybody in the universe is going to be humans. And that's going to be great because he wants to make a point about diversity and how we should all be accepting and so on. So he sort of does that deliberately. Later, sci-fi authors end up questioning that. Even in Star Trek itself, right? They finally invent a race in Deep Space Nine that the Universal Translator doesn't work with. And it's like, oh, wow, actual incomprehensibility. That, I think, I would hope, it would be a theme that would emerge in an alien contact story like this now, because it would be questioning one of the unthought, liberal with a small L, assumptions about the, well, all the human beings can ultimately all just get along when we just translate.
Yeah.
So, well, maybe not. And that would be the kind of thing, I think, that one would question in a novel like that. But I don't know. I'm not sure what Heinlein would actually have produced. I would like to have read it. Whatever. I would like to have read it.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Patrick, for leading us in this discussion tonight and giving the kind of lecture that is the reason we're offering this